folks, this is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCrit Podcast. Great to be talking to you folks. I think we have an incredible podcast today. This is part one of the needle versus the knife. Today we're going to talk about needle cricothyrotomy versus surgical bougie cricothyrotomy. Before we get to that, I wanted to make two announcements. Announcement number one, there is a great new podcast on the block called Emergency Ultrasound Podcast. The link is in the show notes, but it's ultrasoundpodcast.com. This is Mike Mallon and Matt Dawson, two Southerners, doing an ultrasound podcast. Very enjoyable to listen to, evidence-based, educational. The problem is they're Southerners. They speak a little slow, but once you get by that, maybe double it up to twice normal speed. It is incredibly good. So I recommend listening to that. I think they have four episodes out right now. You could search for them on iTunes as well. They're not giving me any money. I like the guys. Second announcement. On the last podcast with Isaac Towell, some folks went directly to the site and played his video and thought that was the podcast. That video is not the podcast. That was supplemental. That was added bonus. The podcast is out there. It's either on the show notes or on iTunes. So if you only looked at the video, listen to the podcast as well. That's where the meat of the matter on organ donation can be found. All right, enough of that. Today we have a guest, Min Le Kang, from down under, from the world of my friends, Mike, Chris, Cliff, so many other great emergency physicians and critical care guys. And we're going to talk about needle versus the knife. Let's get right to it. Tell me a little bit about your actual job. Do you spend full time in retrieval medicine?
I spend, I have a half-time clinical position, which involves about a 50-50 split between retrieval and remote general practice, which I guess over there you'd call primary care or family physician. So that's half-time position. And then the other half-time, I'm a clinical educator for Queensland section of the Royal Flying Doctor Service.
And we're going to talk about a debate today, the needle versus the knife. I am excited. And now you, Min, are representing the needle side.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So why don't you tell us why you think for emergency physicians in adult patients that needle cricothyrotomy is superior to surgical techniques? Let's actually bring it to the real world, to cases, and I think we could lay out our respective approaches. So why don't we start with the first case is a patient who had a airway that was predicted to be easy, but just like this sometimes occurs, it turns out it wasn't, and you've had three attempts at orotracheal direct laryngoscopy. Let's say you even had video laryngoscopy available, and you were not able to see anything. Cormac Lehane grade 4, even tried a bougie because maybe you thought you saw a glimpse of the epiglottis, and there's just no go. And you actually put an LMA in. LMA is failing. The patient's now satting 75%. This is clearly a can't intubate, can't oxygenate situation. Now, Min, what is going to be your next steps? And actually lay it out how you would do it in the actual case. You're on your chopper or you're in your ED. What are you going to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, first thing to do from a human factors viewpoint is clearly diagnose the problem. And if you look at a number of cases, when you're working with a limited team and it's a clear emergency like this, you need to clearly shout out and say, this is a cannot intubate, cannot oxygenate. I'm now proceeding to the neck and we're going to have to secure some method of oxygenation in the next 30 seconds or so.
And mate, I'm going to tell you, the airway anatomy is perfectly palpable in this patient we're talking about.
Okay, well, then you've got two options. The quickest one, if you're in the back of a chopper or the back of an aircraft, stuff like that, quite frankly, in my opinion anyway, would be to get a 14-gauge cannula and a syringe, feel for, you know, it could be the cricothyroid. If you can't feel that, whatever, you could just try further down in terms of the midline if you can feel the trachea and try to go through trachea rings. But essentially, you're inserting that at a 45-degree angle, aiming towards the toes, so you're at the head end, and you're pushing that through, trying to aspirate air. As soon as you get air, you push the cannula off, the plastic cannula off, and
and we didn't mention it during the talk, but what Min has told me offline is that at this point he would reattach the syringe to the catheter and reconfirm that he's still getting an easy draw of air into the syringe.
What I have done at that point, but it's different from Andy Hurt's teaching, is then just grab an oxygen line, so just an oxygen line connected to your oxygen delivery sets, and run that at 15 litres a minute, and then just manually hold that oxygen tubing onto the hub of that cannula. And the whole idea of this, you're not ventilating, you're just trying to get oxygen into the trachea so that you are trying to provide emergency oxygenation. Now, what that does is it gives you some breathing space. And how quickly will you do it will depend on how critically hypoxic the patient is. But what I've seen, and the video evidence from the wet labs and my own experience, is that if you provide about 4 seconds of 15 litres a minute through a 14-gauge cannula, that you're going to get about 800 mils of oxygen into that thing. Now, there's a couple of things. If it's completely obstructed airway, completely, which is very unlikely, but if it is, then you do have to be worried about chest wall rise and making sure that the chest wall at least falls to some degree before you do another 4 seconds worth and provide another 800 mils of oxygen. If there is still some partial airway, then it's usually not a problem, but you are providing some oxygen. And what you generally invariably see within about a minute and a half is the sat starting to climb up. At that point, you have an option. You can either just keep doing that and getting further assistance, but in the back of a helicopter, it's just you. So generally what I do at that point is that I hand off to the paramedic or the nurse or whatever, and I just tell them, look, just watch the chest wall rise, look at the sats, provide 4 seconds on of this and keep doing that. And that's just the manual holding on, and it works. Okay. Now Dr. Hurd doesn't, there's a bit more of a formal approach to that where they connect it up with a number of things, but he's got a pediatric T-piece connection that he'd connect up. That's what he does, and he advocates in his hospital. But it's as simple as that. You don't need to have any fancy gear. And anyway, I've seen it work on two occasions. So that's what I do. At that point, what do you do now? You've got some options. The oxygen's coming out, so you've got a bit of breathing space. You can either, and I have seen it done, and done it myself, where at that point you try to reintubate from the top. So you got a bit of breathing space. You try again. And sometimes with the positive pressure coming up from below, from the needle, the airway actually opens up a bit, and actually the laryngeal inlet actually is a little bit more exposed because it's got a bit of positive pressure pushing it up. And that's been documented a number of times, and I've seen it myself. So that would be the next step. But if you got if there's heaps of blood in the airway and you got no chance, then you should proceed to a more definitive surgical airway. And at that point, you've got two choices. So with RFDS, we've got the Melka kit. So you put a wire down, and that's what Andy Hurd recommends in one of his pathways. So we have that. Or you could just, if you're not happy doing that, whatever reason, you could just using the fact that you do now have a cannula in the right place, is you could, while someone's still providing a bit of oxygen, you could get a blade and then try to make some kind of a surgical opening along the axis of that catheter. Generally, I haven't done that. I've just put the wire down and done the milk a bit, and that works fine. So we had a case of Ludwig's angina that was done that way. So that's how I'd approach that. I think I emailed you, but I've ordered about two surgical airway cases in the last couple of years where, done the scalpel bougie and it's just gone incredibly wrong.
I'm going to lay out what I would do, and then I want to play devil's advocate towards the needle approach, and then you certainly could play devil's advocate towards the scalpel bougie approach.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, fair enough. So in this same case, you've already intuited what I would be doing. I will say, for the record, I at this stage no longer recommend the classic surgical airway for any emergency physician. I think it's doomed to failure. And if those were your only two choices between needle crike and a true classic surgical crike, I would agree with you and say needle crike is the superior method for emergency physicians as opposed to ENT surgeons. What opened my eyes and changed my thinking was the advent of the bougie cricothyrotomy, that really was a game changer for me. And in the same patient with palpable anatomy, I personally would make a small vertical incision and then a horizontal incision through the cricothyroid, get my finger in there, and then just place the bougie. Once that bougie is in and confirmed, and I know it's confirmed because I'm going to reach hold up, and therefore I have that sense of security that the bougie is in the right place because I'm going to actually feel it bumping up against the bronchial, I'm now going to be able to railroad a 6-0 trach or a 6-0 endotracheal tube, and I know it's going to go in the right place because there's nowhere else it could go. And at that point, I have a definitive airway done. Dr. Hurd's literature would tell me that is actually quicker than the needle techniques, not as quick as perhaps a direct 14-gauge in, but he didn't have that in his paper. You might know more to that end, Min, but this was the quickest technique. It was the only technique with 100% success rate, and it's the only technique I've used for my past 7 cricothyrotomies, and it is really, I think, directly in the line of what an emergency physician should be able to do. So that is my technique of choice. Now, let me question you a little bit about the needle method, and then you could by all means tell me why I'm wrong in thinking about the scalpel bougie as the method of choice. So the first thing about the method you outline, Min, is you need to have a 14-gauge cannula, or else you're going to be, in my idea at least, you could find sometimes a 16 or usually an 18 is the biggest. Is that going to make a difference?
Yeah, I don't think so, but the literature is a bit scant on this. I'd still try with a 16. 18, I think, is probably a bit too small. But generally, the literature divides it up between cannulas that are over 4 millimetres and those that are kind of 2 to 4 millimetres and stuff like that. So I think practically, I guess it depends on what cannula you got, but I think you will be able to get some oxygen through at least a 16, 14. You'll get some through an 18. So if that's all you got, I guess you know, you've got to make that call with that case. If the issue is that you stop trying to do your airway procedure because the sats were dropping precipitously and you just needed to get oxygen in and your bag valve mask was failing and your LMA didn't work, then getting oxygen through the needle, even if it is an 18, is better than nothing.
Sure.
So does that answer your question?
Yeah, for sure. Now, the next thing is I've done percutaneous tracheostomies during my critical care training, and when I was doing awake intubations up until a few years ago, I was routinely injecting through the cricothyroid membrane with an angiocath. And sometimes it works beautifully, and you get that nice little bubbling of air into your half-filled syringe with some saline in it, and you know you're in. But other times, especially when there's blood or secretions in the airway, you might be in the right place and not get that bubbling of air. Have you run into circumstances where you're not sure where that needle is?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there was one case where you can get blood clot in the needle and you have no idea if you're in the right place. What I could say to that, yeah, so that's obviously a complication that you do need to be prepared for. The advantage is that if you think that's the case, you can always pull it out and try a new needle. Well, hopefully you've got another one. Maybe if you don't, but you could always flush the needle you got and try again. And the advantage of that is that you can try several attempts fairly quickly without hopefully causing too much major anatomical disruption, and get the oxygen in, which is the main thing that you're interested in. It's at that point, the whole aim of the game is to get the oxygenation back up. So I think to me that's still the advantage. But yeah, obviously there'll be times when, yeah, particularly when blood is in the airway, yes, you can have an issue.
Well, that brings up my next question, which is essentially what you're doing is apneic oxygenation. This is not true ventilation, and it's not going to be supplying normal tidal volumes. What you're relying on is a rescue oxygenation technique of apneic oxygenation. But it seems to me that if this patient has shunt physiology of any sort, you're not increasing the mean airway pressure to any extent at all. These patients are obviously de-recruited from the previous intubation techniques. It seems like you're going to flail if the patient does have shunt physiology. It's going to work great on sheep whose only problem is that someone's anesthetized them for this airway lab, but it seems like a possible risk in a really critically ill patient that apneic oxygenation alone is not going to be enough.
Well, look, fair enough. Look, I take your point. But having said that, you in your past lectures have eloquently argued for apneic oxygenation during standard intubation in that very patient group. So, but by your inference, you would say that that technique is still worth a shot.
It's absolutely worth a shot. What I will say is, in a paper I worked on with Rick Levitan, we both of us believe that in a patient exhibiting shunt, apneic oxygenation is a fail. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it with a nasal cannula, because what's the harm? But we don't think that's going to be what sustains the patient. And we're actually recommending at this point CPAP for those patients.
Yeah, look, fair enough. And look, I think that's great that you and Richard are putting out that stuff. I think certainly here in Australia, we've been, you know, looking at all those things you've talked about, apneic oxygenation, and trying those techniques very successfully. I think that how it applies to the needle cryo, look, absolutely. I think, you know, it's not an absolute 100% technique for all your patients. But then again, we're talking about a scenario where you have limited options. And I think it will boil down to what you think will be quickest, what you think will rescue the situation quickest, and actually probably more importantly, how you can make the decision to do that and how you can work with your team member to do it in the safest possible way. I think these situations always freak out everyone, because we don't encounter them that often. But I think a technique that is simple to do, that will give you the quickest result, is probably going to lead to more times of success than not. But yeah, it's not going to lead to 100% success.
Let me ask you my last question. So these catheters that we're using, the 14-gauge standard IV catheters, are actually designed to soften at body temp. That's intrinsic to their design. It's what keeps phlebitis from occurring in these veins. And what I found is oftentimes catheters that seem somewhat rigid and can maintain their shape in the airway as a few seconds go by, 30 seconds or so, become very, very malleable and actually kink with some alacrity. And it's very difficult because there's no way you could know whether the catheter's kinked. How are you even gauging whether the air is still going into the patient or not?
Yeah, look, I think in practice and also during the workshop training, but in reality, we are looking at a number of parameters. If you are able to see chest wall rise, that's good. It's not always there, but that's good. You're obviously looking for a response in terms of improvement of the oxygen saturation. And you're looking for negative indicators, like, you know, so the fact that the neck's not blowing up or so forth. So you're looking for all those things. You can't be 100% sure, but in an emergency, if you can get the needle in, you can clearly aspirate air, and you have the negative indicators of what I've mentioned, and you see some that's about as good as you're going to get.
Well, why don't you tell me why you think that in some circumstances the scalpel cricothoracotomy technique might fail, and you've actually alluded to some circumstances. Why don't you tell me why I'm sending people the wrong way?
Yes, I have audited a case. It wasn't my case. It was a registrar case, but in our state, where they trained for the scalpel bougie technique. And it was in a man who had severe COPD, who was clearly in extremis, and they proceeded to try to do an orotracheal intubation, failed four or five times, and tried an LMA that failed several times, and eventually proceeded to do the scalpel bougie technique, as they were taught. I think the thing is, a couple of things, I don't know if you've found this in your own experience, but certainly talking to, you know, junior doctors and registrars and my colleagues, but people can get really freaked out by the amount of blood that starts to occur when you start to proceed with the surgical airway, and I think that's psychologically very intimidating. We don't train for it that well. In mannequin training, you don't experience that. Probably the closest you get is in the sheep lab training, but unless you actually experience that, in the second case, actually stopped the doctor from proceeding with the procedure. The fact that he experienced so much blood loss that he clearly thought that, you know, the patient was going to exsanguinate, so therefore he stopped the procedure. But So that's a psychological thing, I think, that we kind of underestimate. How we train for that's quite interesting, but I guess, you know, wet lab training is probably the most highest fidelity we can get. In the scalpel bougie, they did encounter a lot of bleeding, and essentially they try to identify the trachea with a finger and then pass the bougie down. Yeah, they railroaded the tube, like you said, and they proceeded to try to ventilate. And unfortunately, it's quite clear that they created a false passage because the neck started to swell up and the chest started to swell, and essentially the guy went into PEA arrest and died. Mm. So I think I just want to give people that caution that there are cases out there where scalpel bougie, you know, does fail, and that there are a number of reasons why that is. I think the blood factor is one reason people should be prepared. So training in a cadaver, training in a mannequin thing doesn't give you that. So you've got to seek out other ways to try to prepare yourself for when the blood starts to flow, what you need to do. So I'd be interested with how you find that for yourself.
Yeah, I think you – and we're in absolute agreement on this. Dr. Hurd's conclusion was that even though bougie cricothoracotomy technique probably had some advantages in his lab, anesthesiologists just weren't comfortable with it, and that barrier was enough to say that the first technique should be needle cric. And I 100% agree. My wife is an anesthesiologist. I think that would be her first technique, and I think that's absolutely the way to go. If you are an emergency physician and you decide to make scalpel cricothyrotomy with a bougie your first technique, then you have to be prepared to understand that this is a blind technique, and you have to get over the psychological barrier of the huge amounts of blood this inevitably is going to cause on every single one I've seen. If you think you're going to see anything, then you're absolutely deluded. And if you are going to freeze up amidst that blood or do the common and yet deadly mistake of trying to stop the bleeding instead of continuing the airway, then it's going to be a fail. But if you understand those two, and for me, the way I train my residents is I actually blindfold them, and they have to do this just with their tactile sensation as opposed to looking at our model, then go with a needle. But you're absolutely correct. The bleeding is going to be copious. You're not going to see anything, and you have to be prepared to do it anyway. Now, as to the false passage by the bougie, if you're not feeling hold up, if you're not confirming your location, then you're going to be screwed. And you're absolutely correct, man.
Yeah, look, I think it's just something that you know, we kind of in our standard training, we say, you know, this is how you do it. This is the anatomy. And, you know, once you open up the cricothyroid membrane, it should be fairly easy. But certainly that case I cited and a number of ones where, you know, the blood factor is a big issue. And I think the other thing I guess I want to highlight is that we have to approach training for a fairly common denominator, and that we are expecting not everyone to be, you know, a fully trained ENT surgeon. We are, you know, expecting everyone to be a fully trained emergency physician or a critical care doctor. So we do have to address it at a level where, you know, fairly junior providers can, if they do, you know, if we are expecting them to do emergency airway management, that they can do a technique that and understand it in a way that will psychologically prepare them for success. And I think that's important to be sure of. So I think that you know, part of the reason why I think scalpel bougie is useful is that, you know, it does, I think, increase the chance of success. But we shouldn't give it a kind of a mythology to say it's, you know, it's going to be your go-to thing, and it's going to get you out of trouble all the time. So I think, and unfortunately, with a surgical technique, is that once you it's a fully committed technique, as you know. Once you do it, your chance of doing something else is very limited. Now, so your chance of going back and doing a needle, I mean, it is possible. So if someone's got impalpable anatomy, and you just have to cut the, you know, the subcutaneous tissue just to try to find out where the anatomy is. You know, that, as you know, that is described in Dr. Hurd's work, where they do a surgical incision to try to find the trachea and then insert a needle in. And I have to say, there's been a number of times I've seen this where you get the needle in, everyone's a bit more calm, the sats are coming up, and you try again from the top to reintubate, and actually you're successful. And the only thing that stopped you doing initially was that they were so unwell that they desaturated so quickly that you just didn't have enough time to do all your kind of, you know, finer advanced techniques for improving your success of tracheal intubation. So I've seen that a number of times, and And wouldn't that be better that you actually are successful with the orotracheal approach, so people do avoid a surgical airway?
Well, you know, you've actually come to the exact last point of discussion I wanted to bring up. So it's fantastic. You're sending us right where we need to be, which is the second case is the same patient, except now there's no palpable external anatomy. You can't even feel trachea. And as you say, Dr. Hurd in that situation recommends actually making a vertical incision and cutting through subcutaneous tissue until you can now physically feel the trachea. Now, it sounds like, Min, what you would do at that point is continue with a direct insertion of the needle now that you can palpate the structures. And I would say, in that circumstance, this is the perfect opportunity to now find the cricoid and thyroid cartilages, which are easily palpable now, and get a definitive airway. And I could see arguments on either side. Now, why would you put a needle in at that stage? And I agree, it would be nice to intubate from above, but we already have a big vertical incision. So making an incision through the cricothyroid and putting something in there is no different than putting a needle in terms of temporizing and allowing intubation from the top. So why a needle at that point?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on at what point you are in your resuscitation. If the sats are fine, I agree. I think proceeding with your definitive airway makes sense. If the sats are no good, why would you want to proceed with your, you know, surgical air, with your open surgical airway, scalpel bougie, whatever you want to do, when the sats are, you know, down in the boots and you risk them going asystolic or PEA or whatever during that procedure? It's a bit of a gamble, I think, and I think if you know, you can always insert, it's been described and I've done it, where you can insert the you know, you find the trachea and you actually insert the needle between the tracheal rings and provide oxygen that way, and you can leave the cricothyroid membrane, you know, completely for someone else to have a go at, and that works fine. I think it's up to you. I mean, if the patient is satting okay, then yeah, you can proceed and you have time. It's just when you don't have time, what do you do? Do you take the gamble and hopefully you can get, you know, the size 6 tube through the cricothyroid as quickly as you hope, or do you want to start just getting some oxygen in now that you've identified the anatomy? The other thing that we have been doing now, which is following on from some work that Andy's published, but also I imagine you've probably started to do as well, because I know a few of the advanced practitioners I communicate with have started doing it, is to use ultrasound to locate in the impalpable anatomy patient, is to early in your airway assessment, is to get an ultrasound on, and clearly identify the trachea is one, in the midline, two, where the cricothyroid membrane is, three, how tall it is, and then mark it. And that's, we've done that on a couple of times. It's actually worked quite well. That's the kind of the impalpable anatomy case here.
I love it, and I have those references to put in the show notes for the listeners. I think we've come, and we're at the end now, so it's perfect. I think we've come to the crux of our debate, which is what we as individual practitioners feel is the bigger gamble. For me, a patient who's satting 60%, I know they're on the portion of their oxyhemoglobin desaturation curve where they have maybe 5-10 seconds before they go into cardiac arrest. For me, the gamble in my mind is hoping that the needle is going to work, that it's going to actually overcome shunt physiology, and pray that gets the sat up, versus what I think is a sure thing, which is cutting to air at that point and putting in something definitive that I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, once it's in, the patient's going to recover their sats. You, Min, and you correct me if I'm wrong, feel that someone who might not be as experienced with these techniques, doing it once every 5 years to take that scalpel and hope that they have the wherewithal to cut enough might be the bigger gamble, and they should go with what they're familiar with, putting the needle in and reoxygenating through apneic oxygenation. Am I correct in the assessment here?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think that's a great summary. I'd say that, you know, what's the average experience? The anesthetic literature says that once in a lifetime, an anesthetist, you know, once every, you know, 20 years, they will have to do this procedure. And so therefore, when they have to do that, you know, I think making it simple and that's an anaesthetist, a fully trained anaesthetist. What for people like, you know, your ED residents and stuff like that, having something quick and simple, I still think is an advantage. it's an advantage to have that in your repertoire. And some people argue you should only do one thing because it's simple. In human factors training, just learn one thing, do it well, and it'll get you out of trouble. That unfortunately is not real world reality. But I think it's great. Well, that was a great suggestion you said about your residents for doing blindfold. I think I'm going to take that away and we're going to try that in our training. I hadn't even thought about that, so that's a great idea.
What I will say is if you decide that your go-to technique should be needle cricothyrotomy, it makes sense to me, and you tell me if you disagree, man, to have the true dedicated devices meant for it, that the catheters that are not going to get malleable, that are going to stay nice and stiff, that are going to be big bore. And I understand that Dr. Hurd's research would say a 14 gauge is perfectly adequate. But if you are going to make this your go-to technique, shouldn't we have the dedicated devices to make it happen?
Yeah, look, I mean, that makes sense if you have the opportunity and the resources and to do that. I think that makes sense. So, you know, the literature talks about the, I think it's the Ravusin. A catheter, you know, that's been published several times. So that's and there's the ENK kit from Cook, which we have in our kit. So having a dedicated thing, but I think the salient thing, I guess, medico-legal issues apart, is that in practice and in the research in the wet lab, is that a standard 14 gauge cannula is adequate. You don't need fancy gear to do this. And when people say, well, you need to, you know, connect it up to a T-piece and stuff like that, no, that's not true. Me and another practitioner, we've done a couple where we have just held the oxygen tubing onto the hub of the catheter. It's got the sats back up and it's allowed us to rescue a situation that was deteriorating. So I'd like to keep things simple in airway management. And I think it goes to that human factors thing that we can only take, you know, three or four things at once, simultaneously as human beings, in terms of our processing. But I agree with you. If you have the ability to, and I think, yeah, absolutely, having it and training with it makes sense. Yeah.
And I will say, in some of his writings, Dr. Hurd, while he has mentioned the pediatric T-piece, also mentions just a three-way stopcock hooked up to the oxygen tubing, which every ED has readily available. And that would also be a very easy-to-construct in real-time device. And you could actually do, as Min states, and hold the oxygen tubing while you have one of your nurses or residents just grab a three-way stopcock and then just interpose that when it comes to the bedside.
Yeah, look, I've done it a few times. It works well. A couple of things is that the three-piece stopcock doesn't naturally fit onto the end of an oxygen tubing. It will fit, but you have to do a reasonable amount of force to do it. And then it will obviously screw on quite nicely onto the end of the cannula hub. That works quite well, but you just have to be aware it doesn't, you know, you need to put a bit of force in to fit it.
Well, any closing thoughts, Min? Because this has been fantastic.
No, look, I think I think it's great that, you know, you bring up these issues. They don't, you know, they're not commonly talked about, and it's kind of a little bit under the radar in terms of the, you know, the application of these kind of very rare situations. So, you know, I think it's great to have the debate.
So, folks, we were lucky enough to have Min Lay Kong, a flight retrieval physician, an ED physician. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on. We really appreciate it.
No, that's no problem, Scott.
So, folks, to sum it all up, I personally feel you only do get to choose one technique because it's wonderful when you're calm and collected to have a number of techniques in your armamentarium. But when the shit hits the fan, when the crap hits the fan and your epi is surging, you will go to the one technique you have trained on most. And I think you should just choose at this stage of the game, one or the other. Are you going to be a needle guy or a knife guy? And after this debate, I'd say either one is fine as a choice, but make it now. If you do decide to go needle, I personally feel you should have that 14-gauge catheter, or preferably one of the commercial catheters, at every intubation and not have to go looking for it in the middle of a can-intubate, can-oxygenate situation. For me, I'm going to stick with the scalpel bougie technique, and I'll tell you why. When the SAT is already 60% and the patient has just seconds before they code, the needle technique gives you no confirmation that it's actually working, Pulse ox lag will guarantee it will be at least 30 seconds and probably closer to 60 to 90 seconds before that saturation rises. And between those 30 to 90 seconds, you're not going to know if that air is actually getting in, if it is getting in, whether it's overcoming shunt, and if it's overcoming shunt, is it enough to bring their sat up? It's not going to give any feedback. You're not going to know. The patient will be coding if it's not working. And if it is, well then fine. But if it's not, you're in real big trouble. With the scalpel bougie technique, you have a cuffed endotracheal tube or trach in the airway that could be immediately, the second it is put in, confirmed with quantitative end-tidal CO2. First breath you give, you will know if that is where it needs to be. And that's how it should be done, is with quantitative end-tidal CO2 confirmation, not with giving a ton of breaths and watching the neck and chest swell up. If the bougie is properly placed, that should never happen anyway. You will get hold up beyond the neck and therefore know it is in the right place. Once that bougie is in the right place, then that tube and trach cannot go anywhere else. All right, so we're running long. I'm going to try to sum it up here. The show notes has a ton of links. We're going to send this to Dr. Hurd, and hopefully he will have some audio commentary. If you want to hear more from Min, the place to go at this stage of the game is the Broom Docs site. Casey is the man. He has an incredible blog, and I will give the links to that in the show notes as well. There's another lecture by Min on psychiatric transfers, which I just loved. All right, folks, that's it for this week. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye.